In the world service of the BBC, this is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Brazil's central bank president resigns, the country's economic crisis deepens. We assess its impact on Brazil's political future and on the world's economy. Albanian rebels in Kosovo have still not released the Yugoslav soldiers they're holding. Will Belgrade lose patience and escalate the fighting? And Australia's Great Barrier Reef is slowly dying. That's what environmentalists say, and they're demanding urgent action. And Japan's peace boat, what is it and what is it trying to do to achieve peace? First, the news, and it's read by Nicola Davis.
BBC World Service. With no sign of an end to the country's economic crisis, the head of Brazil's central bank, Gustavo Franco, has resigned. He's been replaced by the bank's director of monetary policy, and a new limit has been announced for the Brazilian currency against the dollar. There has been a massive outflow of foreign investment from Brazil following an announcement last week by the governor of an important mining state that he intended to suspend debt payments to the federal government. Our Brazil correspondent, Stephen Sveach, reports.
This is a make-or-break moment for the world's eighth-largest economy. Unlike Russia or much of Asia, Brazil has so far managed to stave off strong pressure from the markets for a big devaluation of the currency, the real. But ever since last week's announcement by one of the country's state governors that he was going to default on his debts to the federal authorities, an air of panic has set in. Gustavo Franco's resignation appears to be an attempt to calm things down, but it's a risky strategy. Mr. Franco was a controversial figure who vigorously defended the policy of setting high interest rates. Franco said his replacement, Francisco Lopes, would pursue new, more flexible exchange rate and interest rate policies. Just what this means is a moot point. At the same time that Mr. Franco made his statement, the government also said it was lowering and widening the band within which the real is permitted to fluctuate.
Senior Western diplomats are holding urgent talks with leaders of ethnic Albanian rebels in Kosovo to try to ensure that they carry out a promise to release eight Yugoslav soldiers they've been holding hostage for 5 days. Rebel fighters are guarding the building where the talks are taking place. The European Security Organization, the OSCE, has said it expects the soldiers to be freed unconditionally today. But a representative of the rebels said they were demanding the release of nine ethnic Albanians being held by the Yugoslav authorities. The man accused of leading the group which kidnapped 16 Western tourists in Yemen last month has confessed in court to charges of kidnap, sabotage and shooting at government troops. Standing trial near the southern port of Aden, he said his Islamic beliefs justified action against British, United States and French citizens. Our correspondent Frank Gardner was at the trial.
In a closed white van surrounded by heavily armed policemen, three Yemeni Islamists accused of kidnapping and killing Western hostages were driven up to the courthouse in the town of Zinjibar. After the prosecutor read out their charges, the leader of the accused, Abul Hassan al-Mehtar, lectured the court on his radical beliefs, which he said were shared by 12,000 others in southern Yemen. These included hitting back at Britons, Americans and French people for the policies of their rulers, regardless of whether they were civilians or soldiers. He admitted kidnapping the 16 Western tourists on December the 28th, calling them the grandchildren of pigs and monkeys. He said God had sent them to us, and we did what we did for God. That admission alone is enough to carry the death sentence here, but the two charged with him denied their guilt.
Reports are coming in of another incident involving United States warplanes over Iraq. A Defense Department spokesman in Washington is quoted as saying American planes fired on Iraqi radar sites during a routine patrol in the exclusion zone over northern Iraq. It's the third such incident this week. Following a series of fatal accidents, the Chinese government has ordered a nationwide inspection of all large building projects undertaken in the past 5 years. The official Economic Daily newspaper says departments have been given a month to report the results of the inspections. Carrie Gracie reports from Beijing.
A rash of unusable motorways and subsiding dikes has raised profound questions here about corruption in the construction business. Relevant ministries acknowledge that in many cases, the local officials who oversee the projects, the companies who bid for them, and the inspectors who are supposed to monitor the results are dividing up central government funds to enrich themselves. Shoddy design, low-grade materials and poor workmanship are only too commonplace. Beijing worries that much of the infrastructure investment undertaken to help the economy ride out the Asian financial crisis is being squandered. Unless the problem is solved, Beijing knows its enormous investment in infrastructure will reap only short-term economic return, and in the long term, serve only to endanger lives.
Prosecution lawyers in the case against the Malaysian former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim have amended the charges so that they no longer have to prove he was guilty of sexual misconduct. The prosecution will now try to show that Mr. Anwar misused his power by using to cover up the allegations. Mr. Anwar's lawyers say they plan to call the Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad as a witness to the trial. Dr. Mahathir sacked Mr. Anwar last year. BBC World Service News.
President Cardoso of Brazil's second term in power has begun with continuing economic worries that are not only threatening the country's stability, but may also affect his long-term political future. The resignation today of the country's central bank president, Gustavo Franco, has deepened concerns that the country's economy is nearing collapse. His resignation followed an announcement from Brazil's second wealthiest state, the mineral-rich Minas Gerais, that is suspending payments to the federal government. I'm joined now from São Paulo by correspondent Stephen Speech. Stephen, can you tell us what exactly is behind the resignation of Gustavo Franco?
Well, Mr. Franco himself at his news conference talked about professional reasons. He talked about the strain of 5 years in public office. But I think there's little doubt that this does signal some sort of change in monetary policy. It follows days of crisis on Brazilian financial markets, which in turn follow months of crisis. Since the middle of August, about $40 billion have left the country. Brazil's in the middle of trying to get an austerity program through Congress in exchange for a big international loan. But at the same time, investors just don't seem to be getting any calmer. And to some extent, Mr. Franco does seem to be a sacrificial victim and also signalling some sort of change of monetary policy.
A sacrificial victim for who? To bolster President Cardoso?
I think not. I think in some ways Mr. Franco may be actually quite relieved to go. I think he was undoubtedly speaking sincerely when he spoke about the strains of being central bank governor in Brazil. But I think this, in a sense, it's partly a symbolic move suggesting that there's now going to be a change of direction. Mr. Franco was one of the strongest defenders of the what we can, I think, now call the previous policy, which was to defend the currency, the real, at all costs, even if that meant very high interest rates, which were strangling economic growth. His successor, Francisco Lopez, who, as we speak, is giving a press conference in the capital, Brasilia, is signalling some sort of change, not a big currency.
I'm sorry, we seem to have lost our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Stephen's speech there. I do apologise for that. But I'm joined here in the studio by the BBC's business correspondent, Andrew Walker, who joins us now. Andrew Walker, can you tell us, what's your assessment? What do you think would be the likely repercussions beyond Brazil of Mr. Franco's resignation?
Before I come to that, Zainab, if I could just briefly touch on a point that I think Stephen was trying to make before we lost the line, which is the question of whether what has happened amounts to a devaluation of the Brazilian currency, the real. Certainly some people are saying that with a bit of semantics you can call it that. Brazilians are denying this. They're insisting it's just a greater degree of flexibility. But I think it is important to recognise that it's not the kind of catastrophic devaluation that we saw in Russia last August. So there is clearly an uncomfortable switch in Brazilian monetary policy, as Stephen was saying, but we're still some way from a full-scale crisis in Brazil's own domestic economic policy.
I understand that quite recently the International Monetary Fund agreed a rescue package, I think it was in November last year, for Brazil. And does that mean that we're now going to see austerity measures in Brazil, a squeeze on public spending, tax increases, that sort of thing?
Well, this is precisely what the government has been trying to do ever since it agreed the rescue package with the IMF a few months ago. The great worry for the financial markets is that it won't be able to do it, that it won't be able to muster the support in Congress to get these measures through. Brazil has been had a particularly uncomfortable mix of economic policies, trying to have an exchange rate peg against the US dollar at the same time as having very large deficits in the government finances. That's the kind of thing that's unsustainable for long periods of time, and unless they can make those very uncomfortable, very unpopular adjustments in public spending and in tax collection, then I think there will be more trouble ahead for Brazil in the currency markets.
Well, we know that Brazil is, after all, the world's eighth largest economy, obviously
obviously it's quite an economic giant. So let me go back to my first question to you. Outside of Brazil, what do you think the implications are going to be, first of all, for the region, and then secondly, for the world as a whole?
Well, the immediate effect, if Brazil does come badly unstuck, would be on Argentina, which also has a currency linked to the US dollar. Argentina would become much less competitive, would then almost certainly have to devalue itself, and then I think you would expect to see widespread financial market disruption throughout Latin America. For the wider world, well, we've already seen a bit of financial market problems since the announcement was made. European stock markets are down quite substantially. There's been something, investors have been trying to get back into what are the traditional safe havens, like government bonds, in the rich country government bonds. The Swiss franc has done quite well. And I think in the longer term, we'll also see investors getting increasingly worried about emerging developing country markets more generally, and that can only be unhelpful for those countries.
I'm sure we'll have more on that on our financial news later in the programme. For now, Andrew Walker, thank you very much indeed. As politicians pursue a diplomatic offensive to try to end the war in Sierra Leone, the humanitarian situation in the country is fast deteriorating. A spokesman for the World Food Programme is appealing to both sides in the fighting to allow aid agencies to transport desperately needed supplies to civilians who, for the most part, are too afraid to emerge from their homes to seek food supplies. Paul Harris, the regional manager for the World Food Programme in West Africa, is based in the Cote d'Ivoirean capital, Abidjan. He's been in close contact with his field workers in neighbouring Sierra Leone.
They're telling us that it's getting very bad now. After 8 days without food, water and electricity, people are getting very desperate. We're talking of people suffering from extreme hunger and malnutrition, maybe some people starving in certain instances. They can't access food because they can't venture out into the streets. Either there's fighting in certain quarters or in other quarters where ECOMOG is mopping up, as they say. They've told people to stay indoors for fear of being taken for rebels and being shot. I do know that some people have tried to access some food in some stores, but these stores were overwhelmed, submerged with people looking for food. Also, people are seen begging in some of the streets. The reports that we've received from our people is that the situation is deteriorating rapidly, and unless something is done in the next few days, we're going to be witnessing a catastrophe of great proportion in Freetown.
And how perilous is it for people to emerge from their homes to try to either get food stocks or water?
My sense is people are starting to emerge because they have no choice, and they're willing to face the dangerous situation. In areas where there is fighting, well, they stand a chance of being killed either by the rebels or by ECOMOG. In other areas, they could be mistaken for rebels and be shot or be assaulted somehow.
We've had reports that much of the city is up in flames and that one of the main hospitals has been burnt down. Do you have any idea whether that's true or not, and what impact this is going to have on trying to treat wounded civilians?
I think it's going to exacerbate an already very difficult situation. The reports that we have from our national staff is that, yes, in fact, many houses are being burned. As the rebels are forced out of an area, they burn houses as they retreat.
And what about hospitals?
Hospitals, we've heard that the Konat Hospital has been burnt. That is the main hospital in Freetown. And that is also going to create a lot of difficulties when we do get in and are able to have people treated. The fact that the hospital is not operating anymore will have a major impact. We will have to, humanitarian agencies, that is, will have to move in supplies, will have to set up temporary hospitals and temporary shelters to deal with the people who have been wounded, who are suffering from extreme malnutrition, or a whole host of related diseases.
Paul Ares, the regional manager for the World Food Programme in West Africa. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, why Australia's Great Barrier Reef is slowly dying and what can be done to rescue it. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. A reminder of our main news today. The president of the Brazilian Central Bank has resigned amid concerns about the country's economic crisis and the possibility of devaluation. Last-minute negotiations are underway in Kosovo to try to secure the release of 8 Yugoslav soldiers whose capture by Albanian rebels on Friday caused a new stress for the fragile truce. Well, the promised release of 8 Yugoslav soldiers held by separatist Albanian rebels in Kosovo has yet to happen. Mediators from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, have said they expect the soldiers to be freed unconditionally today. But the deal comes against a background of threats by Belgrade that it will escalate the fighting if the soldiers are not released soon. I'm joined now by the BBC's Jackie Rowland, who's in the Kosovo capital, Pristina. Jackie, have you managed to speak to any of the Albanian rebels? For instance, are they confirming that the imminent release of the Yugoslav soldiers they're holding is unconditional?
Well, Zineb, actually, I'm in the rebel stronghold of Likovac at the moment, where last-minute talks are taking place between Western diplomats and leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Army. The fact that these negotiations are still taking place suggests that the OSCE's statement yesterday about an agreement having been reached was probably a little premature. It seems that the two sides are trying to hammer out the last details that would enable the handover of the Yugoslav soldiers to go ahead.
So you're actually saying that the deal has not really been chipped in stone as we may have been led to believe?
Certainly, that's exactly what I'm saying. And clearly there are talks still going on. They've been talking for about 3 hours today. It is quite clear that there is not a question of an unconditional release. It's clear that the rebels do want something in exchange, and that something is probably the release of some of their fighters. It appears now that basically what they're trying to hammer out is the details of how this might in fact happen, while enabling the Yugoslav side to save face.
So why do you think it is then that we have had fairly confident reports that a deal was had been struck with the Albanian separatist rebels, and yet you're saying that it hasn't? I mean, what's led to this confusion? Doesn't reflect very well on the OSCE.
No, it doesn't reflect very well on the OSCE at all. It does appear that that statement yesterday was somewhat premature. I think clearly the OSCE in Kosovo have been feeling under pressure to come up with some good news. Their verification mission here has come in for a lot of criticism. It's been said that their mandate is weak and they haven't been very effective so far. I think they were very keen to deliver some good news and get some good media coverage, but maybe in fact they're going to get some negative coverage now because that announcement does look as though it was severely premature, in fact.
And if there is this continuing delay, what's going to happen to the overall situation in Kosovo, very briefly?
Clearly, it can't help the situation in Kosovo. It's a very tense situation anyway. Clearly, that situation could escalate, and we could see new fighting if there is going to be a serious delay on the question of these prisoners.
Jackie Rowland, thank you very much. Environmentalists in Australia say the Great Barrier Reef, which is the world's largest marine park, is slowly dying. They're appealing to the Australian government and the international community to implement an immediate rescue package to protect the 2,000 kilometres reef, which stretches along the east coast. The director of the Australian Conservation Foundation, Don Henry, explains.
Last year, the reef suffered the worst coral bleaching that it ever has. This is where corals die, because the water temperatures are up, because of global warming impacts in the region. Some reefal areas suffered 90% death. Along with that, we are seeing some death of some of the reef areas inshore because of pollution from cattle grazing and sugarcane industries adjacent to the reef on the land. So we've got very serious problems, and the time for action is now.
And what are you pressing the government to actually do?
The magnitude of these problems, and it's not just any one problem, like the runoff, trawling, mining proposals, and coral bleaching. The cumulative impact of all these threats is such that we really believe an urgent rescue strategy is needed right now, and it needs to address each of those issues immediately, because otherwise we're going to be fiddling while Rome burns, so to speak. We're going to see the reef slowly die, and it's really one of Australia's and the world's great natural treasures, and we can't let that happen.
You say one of Australia's great national treasures, but it's also the world's largest marine park. So how much of this is a problem for Australia, or is it one for the world?
Look, it is fairly a problem for the world because the Great Barrier Reef is inscribed on the World Heritage List for its outstanding values as a very diverse and pristine marine reef system on Earth. But I'd suggest the international scientific community need to encourage governments in Australia to recognise how important this heritage is to everyone in the world. It would be timely for that to happen.
precisely what kind of measures do you want to see implemented?
The key measures that need to happen immediately is prawn trawling. That's where fishing boats scrape the bottom for prawns, needs to be greatly reduced. We have to see a curb on the coastal development pressures. There's quite a lot of development along the coast of the reef region. And importantly, both the sugarcane industry and the cattle industry have to immediately cease land clearing, because we're getting a lot of runoff and silt and mud into the reef areas. And the two final and very difficult ones are, there are some very big oil shale mining proposals directly adjacent to the reef that really should not proceed, and we've got to redouble our efforts to deal with the difficult issue of climate change and global warming here in Australia and all around the world, because that is starting to adversely impact the Great Barrier Reef.
It's quite an ambitious rescue package, Don Henry. How much will it cost?
We haven't costed it in detail, but it is going to require tens of millions of dollars. But the biggest challenge for Australia is it's going to require a very serious policy commitment, tough political decisions by the Australian government.
That was the director of the Australian Conservation Foundation, Don Henry, talking to me a short time ago. The prosecution in the trial of Malaysia's sacked Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has amended the four charges of misuse of power so that sexual misconduct and sodomy no longer have to be proved. The earlier charges said Anwar Ibrahim misused his position to direct the police to get witnesses to deny he'd committed sexual crimes. Now they just say allegations of sexual crimes. Francis Harrison reports from Kuala Lumpur.
Anwar Ibrahim's supporters chanted the slogan Reformasi, calling for political reform in front of the High Court. The small crowd came to present a greetings card to Anwar Ibrahim's family in advance of the Muslim holiday next week, ending a month of fasting. Supporters applauded the handing over of the giant card, which said truth, fairness and freedom should prevail. This was the day the prosecution decided to amend the charges against Anwar Ibrahim. The amendments make it easier to convict the former number two in Malaysian politics, and he still faces more charges of corruption and illegal sexual acts. But the fact that the prosecution is no longer attempting to prove that Anwar Ibrahim committed adultery and sodomy in the ongoing trial must have cheered his family. Reacting to the news, Anwar Ibrahim's wife, Dr. Wan Aziza, issued a statement.
What were the prosecution's motives in these amendments of the charges? Is this an extension of the Malafide prosecution and political conspiracy that the defense had contended throughout? For Malaysians and the world, it does not matter. Anwar will be vindicated with the grace of God.
Family and friends turned up in the court to witness what turned out to be a dramatic day. Among them, opposition activist Dr. Chandra Muzaffar from the University of Malaya, who was not impressed by what he saw.
What has happened so far, I think, has been politically damaging to Dr. Mahathir. There's no doubt about it at all. If you look at the conduct of the trial and the way in which the various witnesses had been brought to court and the way in which evidence has been adduced, there are a lot of thinking people out there who feel that this is a show trial. It's a show trial in the tradition of Stalin's show trials of the 1930s. We're talking of another era and another time in history, but a show trial is a show trial.
The final surprise of the day was the announcement by the defence that they plan to call the country's Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, as a witness, and three other senior ministers. The prosecution do not talk to journalists, but I asked one of the defence team, Gurbachan Singh, if the decision to call the Prime Minister was made on political grounds.
It's a legal decision, nothing to do with politics. We are not concerned with politics. We are only concerned with the legal defence. And our instructions are that this is a political conspiracy. Right? We are not calling everybody. We didn't call the Attorney General. Right? We want to call the right people.
It's not yet clear how the Prime Minister and his colleagues will react to the summons, but the defence are adamant they must all appear in court in the coming weeks.
That was Francis Harrison. I'm joined in the studio now by Kian Wong, who reports for the BBC from Malaysia. Kian, we've just heard, obviously, what Anwar Ibrahim's supporters have been saying, but what reason do you think that the government is offering for amending the charges against him?
Well, according to the prosecution, they feel that there is much greater chance of convicting Anwar Ibrahim on the basis of the corruption charges, and they have had great difficulty, as proven over the last months of the trial, trying to get evidence to convict him on the sexual misconduct charges. However, I think that what's important to point out, as even conceded by senior government officials earlier today who I've spoken to, is that the trial has gone well beyond the courtrooms of Malaysia, and its implications for the government itself are what is most worrying, both for the party's electoral fortunes as well as how the government will run.
Just spell those implications out for us a little bit more, the impact on the government.
The government has had a very difficult time convincing many people in Malaysia, especially the Malay heartlands, the grassroots electorate which support Dr. Mahathir's party, of the sexual misdemeanors, alleged sexual misdemeanors of Anwar Ibrahim. Now, as they change those charges to perhaps something even more specific, it merely confirms a lot of people's cynicism of why this trial went ahead in the first place.
So it confirms many people's views that it is essentially a show trial.
It has become a show trial, I think, despite what the government might want to do.
Kiang Wong, thank you very much indeed. Now it's time for an update on the business and financial news, and here's Jackie Sutton.
British Airways and Japan Airlines are tying up a pact which will allow them to share resources. They both already have cargo transport connections, but are now to share coding and other arrangements. This will allow them to increase substantially their influence and presence in one another's markets. BA is trying to persuade regulators in the United States, the UK and the European Union to allow its huge one-word deal with American Airlines. John Patterson, BA Alliances chief, said that the deal is not a merger.
It's very much the start of a relationship, and I think it's much more likely that we will expand the relationship in a series of other ways, but it's not planned at all to have a merger. It'll supplement our American relationship and our Qantas relationship, and it's in no way is a replacement. It brings in for us a relationship in the Far East, as we call it in Britain. We have relationships already with Cathay Pacific and with Qantas, the deepest of which is Qantas. But we were light from a Japanese point of view. It was a great big market, and we had to have that relationship in place.
The dollar has failed to strengthen significantly against the yen, despite yesterday's intervention by the Bank of Japan. Analysts say the Japanese industry feels the central bank and the government have acted too little and too late, and that exports have been hit by the yen's 30% appreciation since August. And turning now to the financial markets, which have all reacted sharply to the news from Brazil. London's 100-share index has fallen 3.9% to 58.01. Earlier, Tokyo's Nikkei index was up 0.3% at 13,403. On the currency markets, the dollar is worth 112 Japanese yen. The euro is at $1.17 and the pound is at $1.65. And that's the business news.
Thank you very much, Jackie. If you want to tell us what you think about any of the issues covered in NewsHour, whether you agree or disagree with any of the opinions expressed in the programme, we'd be very pleased to hear from you. You can send your comments to NewsHour, BBC World Service, Bush House London, or you can send us an email. The email address is newshour@bbc.co.uk. Now, if you want to tell us what you think about any of the issues covered in NewsHour, whether you agree or disagree with any of the opinions expressed in the programme, we'd be very pleased to hear from you. You can send your comments to NewsHour, BBC World Service, Bush House London, or you can send us an email. The email address is newshour@bbc.co.uk. Coming Coming up in the next half hour, Japan's peace boat, who goes on it, what do they discuss, and what do they achieve? And Judge Goldstone tells us what future there is for the prosecution of alleged war criminals. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. But first, let's have a summary of world news. Here's Nicola Davis.
With no sign of an economic crisis, the head of the central bank, Gustavo Franco, has resigned. He's been replaced by the bank's director of monetary policy, and a new limit has been announced for the Brazilian currency against the dollar. International monitors in Kosovo are holding last-minute negotiations with ethnic Albanian rebels to ensure that they go ahead with a pledge to free 8 Yugoslav soldiers they're holding hostage. The man accused of leading the group which kidnapped 16 Western tourists in Yemen last month has confessed to charges of kidnap, sabotage and shooting at government troops. Two other men standing trial with him denied the charges. Reports have been coming in of another incident involving United States warplanes over Iraq. A Defense Department spokesman in Washington is quoted as saying American planes fired on Iraqi radar sites during a routine patrol in the exclusion zone over northern Iraq. It's the third such incident this week. The Chinese authorities have ordered a nationwide inspection of all large building projects undertaken in the last 5 years, following a series of fatal accidents. The disasters have raised questions about corruption in the construction business. Prosecution lawyers in the case against the Malaysian former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim have amended the charges so that they no longer have to prove he was guilty of sexual misconduct. The European Union's executive arm, the European Commission, is meeting for crisis talks later today in advance of a censure vote in Parliament on Thursday over allegations of fraud and mismanagement. The British House of Lords, the country's highest court, has granted the Chilean government permission to be represented in a new extradition hearing next week against the former military ruler of Chile, General Augusto Pinochet. BBC World Service News.
The Pakistani government says it's still determined to push through a constitutional amendment which would make Islamic Sharia law the supreme law of Pakistan. The amendment was passed by the country's National Assembly in October, but it has yet to go through the Senate. Ministers admit that as things stand, the government doesn't have the two-thirds majority it needs in the Senate. But they say as soon as that changes, they'll try to get the legislation through. Owen Bennett-Jones sent this report from Islamabad.
Tens of thousands of Pakistanis chant for an Islamic revolution. They want religion to play a bigger role in matters of state. And so too does the Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif. Malia Lodi, editor of a leading daily Pakistani newspaper, explains what the Sharia law proposal would mean.
It will give unprecedented power to the government to prescribe what is good and what is bad under Islamic Sharia law. That would give the government the kind of power that I think no government in Pakistan has ever had, not even under military dictatorships, because this will be something that takes precedence over every institution and every other law which is in operation in the country. So what we're looking at is a supra-constitutional, supra-legal and supra-judicial authority being created by the Sharia law.
Younger, listen to your father. Young boy, younger, listen to your father.
The children of the Hussein family sing a Cat Stevens song. The Husseins are a typical middle-class Pakistani family, and they are very devout Muslims. The song is one of the few pieces of Western music ever heard in the family home. The children's mother, a full-time pediatric physician, considers Cat Stevens acceptable because he converted to Islam. She also favors Sharia law.
I think Sharia law should be the supreme law. This was the desire when Pakistan came into creation. They wanted to have an Islamic society. And if Sharia law is implemented in the true sense, in the faithful sense, we would have a social state in which the poor are taken care of. We will have a proper media that will feed right information to our children. We will have an interest-free banking. Women will feel more safe. It would improve our lives considerably.
But opponents of the amendment say that far from being true to Islam, the government is simply trying to use religion to increase its power.
The motivation is that he should rule by decree, without any check, without any balance whatsoever.
Opposition Senator Raza Rabbani.
If you look at Pakistan's history, you will find that whenever a government has been tottering or a ruler has felt himself to be insecure, he has always taken the shelter of religion. And that is exactly what Nawaz Sharif is doing today.
As things stand, the government cannot get the measure through the Senate, where it needs a two-thirds majority. But as all sides acknowledge, Pakistani politics are volatile, and that could change. Mid-term Senate elections, for example, are likely to bolster the government's position in the upper house. Minister for Religious Affairs, Raja Zafar ul-Haq, says the government is prepared to wait.
This measure will be passed in the Senate by two-thirds majority, and luckily there is no time limit to bring it before the Senate.
Sure, but the question is when you get the two-thirds majority. In 1999, will you have it?
If we get earlier, we'll do it earlier. Either in 1999 or 2000, then we'll do it that way.
Pakistani police trained to combat the rising levels of crime. The Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, says Sharia law is important because it will bring about speedy justice and ensure greater law and order. Its opponents, though, say it will just give power to extremist and intolerant forces in Pakistani society. Writer and intellectual Iqbal Ahmed.
If it passes, and it may by the year 2000, because the Senate will change, it will damage Pakistan in many, many ways. It will provide the most fundamentalist elements of this society with a new weapon. These people have reduced Islam to a penal code. They can't conceive of it in any other terms. Therefore, it will harden the tissues of this society.
The constitutional amendment goes to the heart of Pakistan's Islamic identity. And those for and against it do agree on one thing. If it's approved, it will have a profound effect on the nature of Pakistani society.
Owen Bennett-Jones from Islamabad. As conflicts such as those in Kosovo and Sierra Leone continue to claim lives, the international community is often faced with demands by human rights organisations and others to bring the perpetrators of abuses to justice. After the horrific killings and abuse of civilians in both the Rwandan and Bosnian conflicts in the mid-1990s, the United Nations set up a war crimes tribunal to try suspected war criminals. Its first prosecutor was a South African, Judge Richard Goldstone. I asked him what lessons we can learn from the way the international community handled these conflicts.
The first thing we can learn is that these things can happen anywhere. Such huge differences, not only geographical but culturally, between Bosnia and Rwanda, and yet there were such similarities in the terrible things people did to their fellow men and women. In particular, I'd refer to the use of systematic mass rape of women. Why was that used in two such different situations? We must learn, I think, a little bit of humility and not say, well, this only happens in Africa, or what only happens in Europe, or what can only happen in Germany, or whatever the case may be. It can happen anywhere. And the lesson that flows from that is that the international community must find deterrence. And one deterrent, I have no doubt, it's not a cure-all, just to make people accountable.
But one real problem in making people accountable is, that's all very well, but how do you actually arrest them, apprehend them, and bring them to trial?
Well, this is a question of political will. No international organisation can succeed without the political will of governments around the world to support them. Bosnia is a good example. The failure to arrest Karadzic and Mladic and other people is the result of a lack of political will, particularly on the part of the United States, but also some European powers. It's changing for the better, and I think that change can be ascribed to political changes, both in the United States with the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who is a great supporter of the War Crimes Tribunal. And what really began the sea change, in my view, was the appointment of Robin Cook as the Secretary for Foreign Affairs here.
Well, of course, Robin Cook, who you've just mentioned, is one of the key backers of the International Criminal Court. Right. There were discussions about that in Italy last year. Mm-hmm. But where exactly have we got in the proceedings? Can you give us an idea? Are we much closer to seeing an international criminal court?
Oh, indeed. I don't think many of the most optimistic people necessarily believed that there would be a treaty at the end of the Rome conference, let alone one supported by 120 nations.
But the United States was very lukewarm.
They ended up being very strongly opposed.
But surely without the support of what is, after all, the most powerful country in the world, the ICC, if it ever does come into being, is going to be toothless.
Well, I don't think it's going to be toothless. I think it will be weaker by not having the United States there. But I've really got little doubt that sooner rather than later the United States is going to join in.
And is the United States opposed in principle to the setting up of the International Criminal Court, or is it just this key issue of the court's jurisdiction and whether it could try citizens without the acquiescence of the his or her government?
The objection, as you correctly suggest, was to the jurisdiction, and it really is, with respect to the United States, an unhappy policy that they want the International Criminal Court, when it's established, to be able to investigate the citizens of every country, whether but not the United States, without its consent.
So where do we go from here? I mean, what sort of time frame are we looking at? Are we going to see an ICC, International Criminal Court, set up pretty soon?
It's going to take some years. 60 countries have to ratify the treaty before the court can begin its work.
But what do we do then about current conflicts in Kosovo, in Sierra Leone? I mean, as we speak, there are gross violations of human rights abuses. What can we do about those?
The only possibility is for the United Nations Security Council, if it's so minded, to set up similar ad hoc tribunals in the meantime. Because the treaty envisages that happening anyway.
And can it backdate prosecutions, as it were? I mean, at the moment we have talk of former Khmer Rouge leaders in Cambodia perhaps coming to trial. Is that the sort of case that the future court could deal with?
No. The Rome Treaty provides for a court that will be forward-looking. It will have no jurisdiction in respect of past events, and that's sensible.
That was the UN's War Crimes Tribunal's first prosecutor, the South African judge, Richard Goldstone. One group which is trying to encourage peace in the former Yugoslavia and other places of conflict is a Japan-based non-governmental organization called Peace Boat, which offers educational cruises aimed at healing divisions and promoting a greater understanding between different peoples and cultures. Peace Boat has arranged 24 cruises since it was set up in 1983, involving a total of 11,000 people. The most recent cruise, which set off from Liverpool in Britain 3 months ago, docked in Southampton yesterday. On board was one of Peace Boat's organisers, Yoko Furuyama. I asked her to explain how the origins of the movement were based on discussions over how Japanese history should be interpreted.
Back in 1982, there was a dispute called textbook issue. The Japanese government tried to rewrite some Japanese history textbooks that used to say Japan invaded China. They wanted to say Japan went to China instead of Japan invaded China, because they wanted to sound, you know, not too bad. But Asian people were not happy about that because they were invaded, and we were not happy about that because Asian people thought we don't want to learn about our history. So we decided to go to Asian countries and talk to the survivors and learn from their experience about our own history. And so since then, we have expanded the themes. Now we talk about human rights issues, environmental issues, and reconciliation issues as well. But the key is to make a direct contact with the local people.
But you don't just deal with Asia now, do you? You've taken on the entire world in educational cruises that you put on. Tell us a bit about these cruises. Who goes to them? What do they discuss on board?
The passengers are still mainly Japanese people, but they come from all age groups.
But if you have mostly Japanese people on board, how on earth can they discuss issues such as the problems of the former Yugoslavia?
Okay, so the paying passengers were the Japanese, but we do have lots of guests. And we had actually British scholars, about 10 of them, on board. And we do have guest speakers from local countries. For example, we visited Croatia this time, and we had one from Croatia, two from Bosnia, and one from Kosovo, and one from Serbia to join us. And, well, usually in their own countries, they cannot meet each other because the border is not very easy to cross. But on board, you know, they can meet and drink and eat together like they're one family.
But you bring people together, but do you actually achieve anything? I mean, do you have a real impact on political events around the world?
Well, political events at the political level, I don't know. But the people's level, yes. Because, for example, we went to Eritrea. It was fighting against Ethiopia for 30 years. And they had to rip off all the railways in order to make shelters. So the train was not running for a long time. Now they need lots of encouragement. And the peace boats visit drove them to finish the rebuilding of the railway. So when the peace boat visited them this time, the first steam locomotive, the passenger steam train ran after the war. So it's like, it's a peace festival.
But you have hundreds of people on board these cruises.
Yeah.
And when you think of cruises, you think of big money. Where does the money come from to finance your activities?
Well, the passengers pay for themselves, except for the scholars and the guests. The round-the-world cruise for 3 months is only $8,000. That's about, what, £5,000?
That's a lot of money for many, many people. That's more than they earn in a couple of years or, more.
But it's a lifelong education. It's a once-in-a-lifetime educational cruise.
That was Yoko Furuyama, one of the organizers of the Japan-based peace organization Peace Boat. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, we'll be reporting from Washington on the latest developments in the Clinton impeachment trial and why accusations of adultery and hypocrisy are being traded. And of course, we'll bring you the sports news, including a report on the expected resignation of the man described as one of the world's greatest and richest sportsmen. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. And now the latest world news headlines. The president of the Brazilian Central Bank has resigned amid concerns about the country's economic crisis and the possibility of devaluation. Talks are continuing to try to secure the release of 8 Yugoslav soldiers whose capture by ethnic Albanian rebels caused a new stress for the fragile truce in Kosovo. On the eve of the Senate trial of President Clinton on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice, one of his strongest critics has himself been accused of adultery and hypocrisy. With the details, Claire Balderson, who's in Washington to cover the trial for NewsHour.
When the House managers, the people responsible for prosecuting President Clinton, walk into the Senate to open their case tomorrow, one of them will himself be under something of a cloud. The right-wing Republican, Bob Barr, who's been one of Mr. Clinton's most vocal critics, has been accused of hypocrisy by the publisher of the pornographic magazine, Hustler. The publisher, Larry Flint, says Mr. Barr not only had an extramarital affair, but that contrary to his many public statements opposing abortion, he in fact paid for his former wife to have an abortion in the 1980s. Congressman Barr denies the charges.
These are the most private of matters. If my ex-wife has chosen to make certain statements in response for money, I think that's very unfortunate. But again, if I have never, would never perjure myself. So to me, that's a non-issue.
And Mr. Barr also says that these allegations will have no impact on his ability to act as part of the prosecution at President Clinton's trial. But will this type of charge affect the process and the politicians involved? I asked political analyst Stuart Rothenberg of the Rothenberg Political Report.
It will be embarrassing, if true. The allegations will be a huge embarrassment for a handful of individual members of Congress. I think the Republican argument is clear that they are not upset with the president's sexual behavior, although they question his judgment. They're concerned about lying before a grand jury in a deposition, lying to the American public. So they're going to want to draw a distinction. It's clear that Larry Flint doesn't see that distinction, and Democrats are going to be very cautious about jumping on his charges for fear that they will somehow be aligned with him. I don't think Democrats want to be seen as part of the Larry Flint team.
They're making a great effort to keep a distance, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. They realize that if Bob Barr, in fact, did do what Larry Flint says he did, it will be a huge embarrassment for Barr. It could drive Barr out of office. But they don't want to be seen as the culprits, as somehow giving him information or encouraging him to go after Republicans, particularly since Democrats and the president in particular have said it's time to avoid this these personal attacks.
They want to avoid personal attacks, what they call the sexual McCarthyism, the atmosphere of sexual McCarthyism, but that seems to have become unavoidable.
Well, yes, you're right. The American public says that they don't want to hear about these things, but they do want to hear about these things. Everything that I can gather from talking to editors and producers is that TV ratings go up, news magazines sell more copies. So there clearly is a titillation factor. The question is not so much the impact on Bob Barr. I think it's down the road, the question on candidates who may or may not run for president in 2000, for example. That's where we might see a real impact.
It's not just an impact on people at the Federal level, though, is it? Because there will be people at a local level in politics who may be now wondering whether to get involved at all in the political process. That could be damaging.
I think increasingly that's been a concern by anybody who's interested in politics. The danger that someone will go through your background with a fine-tooth comb, look for anything and everything. Politics is by definition a kind of business where it's hard to hide things. But when you have private investigators who are hired to look in every nook and cranny, it makes it that much more intimidating for potential candidates.
Where is all of this going to end? Is it going to end?
Well, we don't know. It could end in one of two or three ways. It is possible that the dirt that is dug up so angers the American public that they decide we need just squeaky clean candidates to make sure candidates have no skeletons in their background. Or on the other hand, the American public might say, look, this is simply gone too far. We're not going to consider these kinds of personal developments and experiences, and let's move on. And in a strange way, I guess it's possible that it could take some of the sexual innuendo off the table. Probably not entirely, however.
Does this tell us something about the media in the United States? Because the mainstream newspapers and television programs have been very cautious about covering these sorts of stories. What we've seen is Hustler magazine pushing this, the Drudge report put out by Matt Drudge on the internet. Are those the people now dictating the news agenda?
Sure seems that way to me. The mainstream media don't want to touch something. They don't want to create the news. But when the news is out there, even if it's put out there by someone who is not reputable, like Larry Flint or Matt Drudge, or by a supermarket tabloid, the mainstream media seem to pick it up. And that means they're reacting to not creating the news.
I was talking there to Stuart Rothenberg of the Rothenberg Political Report. Well, the prosecutors are putting the final touches to their arguments. On Thursday, we'll finally get to hear them present their case. For now, though, that's all from Washington. Back to the studio in London.
And that was Claire Balderson. Thank you very much, Claire. Now for the latest sports news, here's Dave Farrar.
Thanks very much indeed. Now, controversy still surrounds the first test series to be played between India and Pakistan in 13 years. The venue for the opening match on January the 28th has now been moved from Delhi to Madras. The capital will now host the second test. The move follows threats of disruption by religious extremists and to avoid a clash with India's celebration of Independence Day, which is January the 26th. Our reporter in India, Harsha Bogle, explains the quandary faced by the Indian officials.
They're not quite sure they'll be able to guarantee what they've called foolproof security during the first test match if it was played in Delhi on the original dates, which were the 28th of January to the 1st of February. So what they've done, and I think it's a prudent decision, is to move that test match to Chennai, or in case you don't know what Chennai is, it's Madras now, for the first test, and then play the second in Delhi from the 1st of February. That releases the security forces who would otherwise have been engaged with the Republic Day Parade, which you know is a huge pageant in Delhi. A lot of the defense forces are there, and it's really a huge occasion and a very sort of security-conscious area. So the security forces then get released from that duty and they can concentrate on the test match in Delhi. So I think it's a pretty good decision, actually.
Now boxing, and the former world heavyweight champion Mike Tyson has once again been creating the wrong headlines. He returns to the ring against the South African Francois Botha on Saturday. Tyson lost his boxing license 18 months ago after that infamous ear-biting incident with Evander Holyfield. In a satellite link-up from Las Vegas, Tyson said he'd overcome more than his fair share of misfortunes.
No, I've always been an underdog all my life, but I've been an underdog in different aspects. The fighting aspect of an underdog is just a percentage, an aorta. It's nothing compared to I've been an underdog in life. You know what I mean? Everybody else started at zero. I started at sub-zero, and I still surpassed them. You know what I mean? I'm not the ordinary man. I'm the extraordinary man. You know what I mean? I take my will and power and go to levels where no one can go. I can never be a slave. I can never be subservient. You know what I mean? I'm beyond good or evil, right or wrong.
Well, I wouldn't argue with him. Just finally, the British sports minister, Tony Banks, says the sale of Wembley Stadium is a major boost in England's campaign to host the 2006 World Cup. It means a multi-million dollar scheme to redevelop the stadium for the next century can now go ahead. The stadium has been sold to a subsidiary company of the English Football Association and Wembley PLC. Banks says that a new 90,000-seater stadium will now be built as planned. And that's all of the sport.
Thank you, Dave Farrer. Well, staying with the world of sport, America's greatest sportsman, the man billed as the best basketball player ever, Michael Jordan, is expected to announce his retirement today in Chicago. Jordan is known the world over, even in countries where basketball isn't a major sport, partly for his legendary athletic abilities and partly for his product endorsements for everything from sports shoes to soft drinks. These have made him the richest sportsman in history and one of the wealthiest individuals in the world. Our correspondent Stephen Sacker reports on the Jordan phenomenon.
And six. Jordan hangs in the air, yes.
Jordan hangs in the air, a phrase used a thousand times by commentators awestruck by the athleticism of America's greatest sporting hero.
Jordan, it's good if it goes. It does.
Michael Jordan won six national championships for the Chicago Bulls. Arguably, no man has ever dominated a team sport so thoroughly. In Chicago, fans, which means almost everyone, are coming to terms with a grievous loss.
God bless Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan's going to go out a winner. He's a class act. Michael Jordan should be able to do whatever he wants to do, and every fan in the city of Chicago should be happy for Michael Jordan when he makes his decision.
For a decade and a half, Michael Jordan has thrived on fan adulation, not just in Chicago, but across the country. He did try to retire once before, after his father was murdered 5 years ago.
I love the game of basketball, I always will. I just feel that at this particular time in my career, I've reached the pinnacle of my career, but I just feel that I don't have anything else for myself to prove.
Jordan tried to take up professional baseball. He failed. So it was back to the basketball court, where his skills were treated with a reverence bordering on the ridiculous.
Well, here we go again. Michael Jordan going down the runway, getting ready for takeoff. Takes off right, you see, at the bottom of the circle, up in the air. Now, let's see the little move, the double clutch, back up as he floats by. There he is in the slam.
He became known as Air Jordan for his prodigious leaps. He earned many millions by endorsing sports shoes and much more.
Like Mike.
Who wouldn't want to be like Mike? He became a one-man corporation. His $20 million a year basic salary was far outstripped by his off-court activities. Significantly, Jordan is leaving the Professional Basketball League, the NBA, at a time of crisis in the sport. A player lockout has wrecked the season before it's even begun. Some say basketball is on the slide. Bob Green, columnist on the Chicago Tribune, thinks Michael Jordan is once again displaying his impeccable timing.
Jordan has always associated himself with top-rank blue-chip companies for his endorsements, for his business associations. And I think a pretty good argument can be made that right now, the NBA is not a top-flight company. The players and the owners left a very bad taste in the mouths of fans around the country. And Jordan's not in the business of leaving a bad taste in people's mouths.
Michael Jordan's greatest moments will be relived again and again. In his sport, he was gracious, dignified, an American hero. In retirement, he can concentrate on his greatest talent of all, making money.
And they are going wild in the Windy City.
And that report by Stephen Sacker ends this edition of NewsHour. From me, Zainab Badawi, and the rest of the NewsHour team here at Bush House in London, goodbye.